May it please the court. I'm Shan Jeffrey here on behalf of Michael Pearson. My number is 28689. And this is the case in which a 7-year-old girl alleged acts of sex assault in significant sensory detail against her uncle, who's the defendant. And during this time frame alleged by the girl, it was later discovered that her teenage cousin, whom she greatly admired, had committed similar acts of sex assault against her, well, acts that were strikingly similar to those alleged against the defendant. And the cousin admitted to these acts, so that's not a fact in dispute. Now, all the issues that I've raised in this appeal, I believe, are very important, but I want to focus on the rape shield issue because it's so controversial. My briefs articulate several arguments for why this evidence is relevant and admissible under the different subsections of the rape shield statute. And those include an alternate source of bodily injury, because that was charged as part of the crime of violence, an alternate source of sexual knowledge, and motive to fabricate. And I'd like to step back from the trees to see the forest of this issue, so to speak, because really the question boils down to one idea. And that is, did the legislature intend the rape shield statute to exclude this type of alternate suspect evidence? Evidence of a known sexual assault committed on the child victim during the same period in the same manner as that alleged against the defendant, but concededly committed by somebody else. Now, I think it's important to acknowledge that the rape shield statute, by its plain language, never intended to establish an absolute bar to evidence of other sex acts involving the alleged victim. The statute only establishes a presumption of irrelevance for certain evidence, and presumptions are rebuttable under the right circumstances.
And the way you rebut it is by showing it's relevant to material fact, right?
That's right. Or that it doesn't even fit within the presumption of irrelevance in the first place. And I've argued both in my brief. And no one is disputing that there are very sound principles underlying the protections of the rape shield statute. When it was newly enacted, our Supreme Court articulated the very sound public policy supporting it in People v. McKenna. I've cited that brief in my brief. The court explained that the statute's purpose is to protect victims from humiliating public fishing expeditions into past sexual conduct. And in other words, as a public policy matter, the jury should not be tainted by innuendo that a victim is promiscuous, she's had numerous voluntary sexual partners, and is therefore less likely to be a victim of sexual assault in this particular case. The legislature determined that inviting prejudice by the jury based on preconceived notions of the sanctity of chastity is not a legitimate defense tactic. And the legislature determined that the alleged victim's background of sexual conduct is not relevant to whether sex assault occurs at a later time. And
Can I ask you this? Your position on the knowledge issue.
Okay.
Is your position under the case law you cite New Jersey and Connecticut and a bunch of other states, is your position that whether or not the prosecution does anything to open the door that a 7-year-old that describes, as you talk about, sensory detail, and as the prosecutor, I think, said in closing, but without any prosecution action, is it your position that, per se, a 7-year-old that describes detailed information, her prior sexual assault or by another person would per
or
se
concurrent.
Be relevant?
Simultaneous.
Victimization by another person would automatically be relevant?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that there's an inference hanging out there that a 7-year-old would not normally have precocious sexual knowledge. I do think that's true. I think that's something that the jury is aware of no matter what, unless some evidence has come in to explain precocious sexual knowledge, why this 7-year-old might have it other than having been sexually assaulted. However, in this case, we do have prosecutorial argument that she had precocious sexual knowledge. That terminology, that nomenclature was not used, but she did say that this was described in significant sensory detail, which implies precocious sexual knowledge. So we do have that in this case.
And that was in closing argument, the initial close?
I can't remember if it was rebuttal or initial, Your Honor, but it was in closing argument. I believe it might have been in rebuttal, but I'd have to go back and check. So I was going back to the public policy behind the Rape Shield statute, and it's a strong one, but it's not the situation that we have in this case. We're not talking here about evidence of a woman's reputation for sexual promiscuity or chastity, and we're not talking about past voluntary sexual conduct. We're talking about a 7-year-old girl who's sexually assaulted by her teenage male cousin and then alleges the same type of sex assault against her uncle. And we're not talking about reputations or promiscuity or public fishing expeditions. And we're not really even talking about the victim's sexual conduct. We're talking about sexual conduct of one, at least one, perpetrated upon her. So
well, that argument, I think, has been rejected in Kyle. I understand Kyle's distinguishable, but the argument that it only applies to somebody that engages in consensual activity as opposed to the victim, Kyle rejected it. I think the New Jersey Supreme Court and Buddhist, I think a lot, every court, save a few, has rejected the argument that as a matter of policy, it shouldn't apply when the person's a victim.
I understand that, but I'm trying to go back to the roots of the Rape Shield statute, the public policy from which it first emanated, to see how far we've come in our inclusiveness in broadening the shield from its original purpose. So here we have a little girl who's sexually assaulted by the very cousin that she considers her hero. And this is a big conflict of interest. And it's fathomable that she may not have known how to handle that situation without either confusing things in her mind or bending the truth. And a defendant has a right to a constitutional right to present a complete defense. And Supreme Court cases from way back have held that consistent with this right, a defendant may present evidence that another person might have committed the charged offense. Now, we know the legislature was aware of the need for alternate suspect evidence in sex assault cases because of the language in the first part of the Rape Shield statute, where it provides that the presumption of irrelevance does not even attach to the source or origin of physical evidence of a sexual encounter, offered for the purpose of showing that the act or acts charged were or were not committed by the defendant. So the legislature contemplated this type of evidence, and certainly we've argued that the physical evidence of the cousin's assault, which the victim complained of pain, and so Mr. Pearson was charged with bodily injury, that evidence of his causing her bodily injury was admissible to show an alternate source of injury in this case for purposes of crime of violence.
Isn't it possible that she experienced pain in both assaults from both perpetrators?
It is, Your Honor, but we still have the issue of causation. Even arguendo, assuming she was assaulted by Mr. Pearson and her cousin, the cousin could have caused the injury, and the pain she felt later from a later touching could have been caused by the initial injury by the cousin. So there's a causation issue here, and the jury needed to hear the evidence.
As long as she had pain on the second incident from the defendant?
Because if she had not been injured by the cousin first under the scenario, it may not have caused her pain on a second touching.
What?
The pain may have resulted from an initial injury from cousin, that's a contemplatable scenario here.
Was there any medical evidence offered that she had been physically injured by the cousin?
The same evidence of bodily injury was available for both of these people.
That wasn't my question. Was there any expert medical testimony that she had been physically injured by the cousin?
There was no expert medical testimony in this case whatsoever. And yet the jury found bodily injury based on her testimony of pain caused by Mr. Pearson's touching. But the same evidence, the same medical testimony, her own, of pain was available against the cousin as well.
Wouldn't
same
be a
evidence.
Fair inference that if a 7-year-old is assaulted the way that she claimed she was by the defendant, that close to per se would be significant bodily injury?
No, I don't think so. You can have a digital intrusion, which is included in the definition of sex assault that we have here, which is a mere touching and does not require penetration, would not necessarily result in pain.
But her testimony was much more than that.
Was it?
Wasn't it?
Which part of her testimony are you referring to?
I'm talking about the testimony that when she described the acts that had been perpetrated allegedly by this defendant, Couldn't the jury infer from that 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 would be the type of act that would lead to significant bodily injury to a seven-year-old?
Perhaps, but the same acts were described with respect to the cousin.
So couldn't they infer that both those acts are the type that independently would cause significant bodily injury?
They could have, but they also could have inferred only the cousin or the cousin first. We don't know because the evidence was not allowed. The deprivation of the alternate suspect defense in this case was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury was not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt of several of the counts against Mr. Pearson. He was acquitted of many of these counts. Evidence of an alternate suspect was very likely to influence the remaining verdicts. I'll save the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people in this matter. The evidence of the abuse by CK's cousin was not admissible under any exception to the rape shield statute. I'll just go through all of the reasons that the defense offered the evidence. The evidence didn't come within the exception for physical evidence under 18.3.407.1b, and I think that issue was already decided in Kyle. Pain is not physical evidence. I think the sort of key to this physical evidence is some type of tangibility. And I think it's interesting that the defense was arguing up and down at trial that there was no physical evidence, and yet on appeal and also in the trial court with respect to the rape shield statute, they were arguing that it should come in under that exception. The evidence didn't fit the false reporting exception, and I outlined this in my brief. I think also, first of all, this claim was rejected in Kyle because CK's report about her cousin was true, and that was also the case in Kyle. So there's no false reporting because it was true. And I do want to I think a false denial of a sexual assault that did occur is distinguishable from false reporting. The next issue I'll talk about is this whole motive to lie and repackaging transfer, because I think it all needs to sort of come from this motive to lie. The defense theory was that CK repackaged or transferred this abuse by her cousin to her uncle because she didn't like her uncle because he wouldn't let her watch cartoons or they were having some sort of disagreement over the remote control. And I just want to point out also, when you look at the defendant's testimony at trial, he testified that he had a good relationship with CK. So I think that sort of shows you, I think he could have testified that, you know, perhaps she had a motive to lie because she didn't like him, they were having these fights. His testimony was that they had a good relationship. So I think that sort of shoots this whole motive to lie. And I think also when you talk, even if we assume that, you know, she didn't like her uncle, there's just no evidence of any sort of repackaging or transfer. In the Kyle case, a division of this court held that, you know, there's no evidence to, if there's no expert or other sort of psychological testimony to support any sort of repackaging or transfer, it's just not enough to say, well, there was another assault, so, you know, this victim must have fabricated things because of this previous experience. There's just no connection in this case, and I think the trial court ruled correctly on that basis. And next, I'll deal with the source of CK's sexual knowledge. The prosecution did not argue in this case that the victim had any sort of precocious sexual knowledge. She said she described the events of the assault by her uncle in great detail.
Ms. Idala, let me interrupt you on this point. There is case law, I think, from probably the majority of other states that have decided the issue, saying that when you have a very young victim, as this person certainly is on the young side of child victims, that the issue of knowledge is almost inherent in the case, and that a jury would draw the inference that how could a seven-year-old girl be expected to be testifying like this unless she were, in fact, abused? And then, therefore, she must have been abused by this defendant because they've heard no other explanation of that. Do you think that reason is just wrong? Before you get into the opening the door issue, do you think that that's incorrect reasoning?
Well, I think it's distinguishable when we say sort of precocious sexual knowledge versus what happened in this case, which is I think she described all of the events that she described were in age-appropriate language. You know, if she were describing, you know, events that, you know, certain, like, I don't know, sexual positions or something that she couldn't only, you would only know if you had been abused, I think that's different from a case where she's saying, you know, describing what, you know, what the abuse felt like in terms that were, you know, understandable to her. I think that that's different.
Well, wouldn't you say that she's describing acts that hopefully most seven-year-olds would not think of, most seven-year-olds would not think of kind of creating this type of allegation, would they? Isn't that an inference that a jury would rationally draw, that if a seven-year-old's saying something like this, something must have happened to this girl?
I mean, I think that's one position. I mean, I think that's certainly an inference from it, but I think, you know, the fact that the victim was describing the events in age-appropriate language, it felt like something pinching me, it is something that it's within her vocabulary, and it's something that she could describe.
And do you agree the standard is under the Rape Shield statute, if it's not within the, if it's presumptively unreliable or irrelevant, that the defendant has to simply show it's relevant to a material fact, and therefore the defendant would carry the burden of, if the defendant proves relevance to a material fact?
I think the defendant needs to prove, I mean, we have these more specific exceptions under the Rape Shield statute. You know, we're talking about, you know, false reporting or some kind of physical evidence, and then we also have...
Let's assume we agree it's not within one of those exceptions, that it's simply, therefore, it's presumptively irrelevant is the legal effect of that, if it's not within one of the specific exceptions.
Yes, it is. And then we do have, I think our Supreme Court has said, well, if it is sort of more, I don't want to call it maybe a catch-all, more relevant to a material fact, and it does seem like there is case law supporting that. But I do think you still need to meet a threshold relevance. I don't think it's enough to say. It seems like the defendant here is just trying to make a more general sort of credibility argument, and I do think it needs to be more specific. And that's why I've really tried to focus on this motive to lie and repackaging, just to show that there's really nothing there. There's got to be something more there to make this evidence admissible.
No, that's why I was kind of homing in on the knowledge issue. I think the precocious knowledge. So apart from the fact that it arguably may be in the case with any young child victim, what do you say to the closing argument that why should you believe this young child because she testified in significant sensory detail? Isn't that asking the jury to draw an inference? Precisely what I'm suggesting may be in the case anyway.
It's asking the jury to draw an inference that the defendant committed the acts. I mean, it's not just about sensory detail, about the type of conduct. I mean, all of the events were specific to the defendant, you know, what she was wearing, where they were. None of the abuse by the cousin or any sort of alternate suspect type evidence dealt with those specific details. And I think I mentioned this in my brief, that the two events were, similarity is not enough under Kyle, but I think the two assaults were actually not similar, and that's because the defendant really was the only source of the little girl's sexual knowledge of an adult male's genitalia. The cousin was, I believe, had more of the physicality of a prepubescent boy. But I think also, in addition to the two events not being very similar, just with this alternate suspect type evidence, and I think Judge Terry touched on this a little bit, the defense's position sort of assumes that there was just one assault here. And we're not dealing with, one specific physical tangible injury, a broken leg, who did it. We have nothing, it doesn't make it any more or less likely that the defendant and the cousin both committed these assaults. So I think the prosecutor's argument that, you know, she gave you all of this detail, I mean, that's true. She gave a lot of detail about the assaults by her uncle. It doesn't say anything about other assaults, irrelevant assault by her cousin. And I think the last argument that the defense made was that this this evidence of the cousin's assault was relevant to show the source of some sort of psychological or emotional injury that CK suffered. And I really do think that this is just a restatement of the argument that was rejected in Kyle. You know, just some sort of similarity. I mean, if that were the case, that you could say, well, there was some kind of emotional damage, then the prior assault is always going to be relevant because all sexual assault victims suffer emotional damage. So that's not enough to rebut the presumption of irrelevance and bring in evidence of a prior assault. If the court has no further questions, the people would request and that the court affirm the judgment.
First, I'd like to point out that the first part of the sex assault statute does not require physical evidence per se. In that first section, where it's talking about source of semen or source of origin evidence, if you look at it conceptually, it's describing alternate suspect evidence. It uses examples of physical evidence, but it is not limited to those specific examples.
Well, didn't Kyle address that when it focused on the use of the term similar in the statute?
But what does similar mean? Does it have to be DNA evidence? Here we do have physical evidence at issue. We have evidence of her bodily injury. Now, the testimony itself is not physical evidence, but it's testimony about physical evidence. And that's all you need under that first section of the statute. In a broader sense, it's also just alternate suspect evidence. And I think that the term similar, if you look at it conceptually as alternate suspect evidence, could include much more than what we've been talking about here. It could really include any relevant alternate suspect evidence. On the issue of precocious sexual knowledge, I just wanted to refer back to the question that Judge Connolly was asking and point out that the fact that this child did not necessarily use adult terminology in describing acts that, as you pointed out, one would hope a 7-year-old would not necessarily be cognizant of had she not been sexually assaulted. The fact that she doesn't use adult terminology does not mean that it's not adult or precocious sexual knowledge. And if you go back to the Buddhist case that I refer to, I think that's an excellent example of the way a court can handle this type of information, make sure the jury is only applying it to that inference of precocious sexual knowledge with the use of a limiting instruction to make sure that the jury does not misuse that information for a presumptively irrelevant purpose. And lastly, on the Kyle case, you know, it's true there are some similarities between this case and Kyle, but it's the differences that are dispositive. And the big differences are that A, Kyle was decided under the 403 rationale, and that is necessarily a case-specific analysis. So it's not binding on any other cases. Number two, the Kyle case involved a teenager who would have had presumptively some sexual knowledge apart from having been sexually assaulted prior. Here we're talking about a 7-year-old, so the whole precocious sexual knowledge issue is completely different in Kyle and in this case. Also in the Kyle case, that was talking about an alleged prior sexual assault that did not encompass the time frame of the assault charged in the case in Kyle. Here we have, and I think it was conceded by my opposing counsel, we have a sex assault that was conceded by a different perpetrator that occurred in the same manner and encompassing the exact same time frame as the one charged in this case. So here we have alternate suspect evidence for an assault charged within this time frame. And in the Kyle case, it wasn't alternate suspect evidence. It was a repackaging defense based on, well, if it happened to this teenager before, he could easily concoct a story now that would be convincing based on his knowledge of his prior sex assault. And really, it's two different situations.
In terms of the similar matter argument just made, can you respond to the opposing counsel's point about the different physiology of this adult male defendant and the, she called the prepubescent other perpetrator?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that was firmly established. Obviously, Mr. Pearson is an adult male, but since we did not get to explore that evidence in detail and admit it to the jury, we really don't know what this teenager's genitalia looked like. We have an auntie's description of him being not, you know, physically mature for his age or something like that, but I don't believe we have any photos or anything of that nature, Your Honor. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counsel are excused, and when the tables are cleared, we're ready to take up our next case.